Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybrow. Today we're joined by special guest Catherine Lester to talk about Watership Down, both the 1972 novel and the 1978 animated film. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Hello. Hi. This is usually the point where I say, hi, Adam, but we're leaving that for now. That's not important.
I'm here too.
Because we have a guest with us today on this episode. We can also say hi to Adam. But Catherine Lester is a lecturer in film and television at the University of Birmingham. Her research centres on the intersections of the horror genre and children's cinema, which is the subject of her monograph, Horror Films for Children, Fear and Pleasure in American Cinema, on Bloomsbury 2021. She's also published on a variety of topics relating to children's media, including a chapter on children's horror television in the book Global TV Horror, and a chapter on representations of female solidarity and villainy in Frozen in the book Discussing Disney. Her next project is an edited collection focusing on the 1978 animated film Watership Down, to be published by Bloomsbury in late 2022. Hi, Catherine. Thank you so much for agreeing to chat with us today.
Hi, and thank you so much for inviting me to chat with you about all things scary and childish.
Yeah, I can't imagine better credentials for appearing on this podcast than that biography. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Yeah, I've got a copy of Catherine's book here with me, Horror Films for Children, Fear and Pleasure in American Cinema, which I've been really enjoying. I must say that your definition of horror films for children is far more academically rigorous than ours.
I felt like I kind of had to draw some boundaries. Otherwise, feasibly, the book could have addressed anything that children watch that is remotely scary or maybe unintentionally scary, and that would just be too much. And I looked back through the history of the things that you've discussed on the podcast, and I'm really impressed actually that there's just so much there that I've never even heard of, which I think goes to show just how much there is in this area, but also that the need for me to sort of narrow down my boundaries a little bit.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because when we started the podcast a few years ago now, you know, I remember Ren saying, I don't know if we're going to have enough, you know, this might be quite short-lived, and that's really been far from the case, that we never run out of material. But do you want to explain what your definition, your working definition of children's horror or children's horror films is in your book?
So I focus on films which were intended to be for children, first of all, And then the question is, well, how do you separate children's horror films from other kinds of children's films? Because obviously horror, if it's too scary, it risks being not suitable for children, and if it's not scary enough, then it risks being considered not horror. So there's a really delicate balancing act. And so because of that, children's horror tends to overlap quite a lot with other genres like fantasy and like comedy. So I decided to focus mainly on films where they seem to follow this a kind of standard horror structure and dealing with specific kinds of themes, like encountering the monstrous, films that are trying to evoke feelings of fear and disgust and that kind of thing. So that would include films like Gremlins, which is on the cover of the book, one of my all-time favorites, films like Paranorman and Coraline, which are both animated films by Laika Studios, The Witches, and all kinds of films.
A few of which we've covered. We did Paranorman and we've done The Witches. With Coraline, we're sort of saving it for our 100th episode because we're both big fans.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of the inspirations for doing the podcast in the first place.
We feel like it needs a specific occasion to be made of Coraline.
There is a new book that's just come out about Coraline, the film, actually. And that's also with Bloomsbury, edited by someone called Misha Mihalova, I think. So you should check that out.
I know there's a new collection coming out sometime in the future on Nightmare Before Christmas as well, which was my favourite film as a child, and definitely very formative for me. I find it interesting that you mention it, obviously, but say you don't consider it a children's horror film because Jack Skeleton is very much an adult character with adult concerns, I suppose, rather than a child substitute.
Yeah, so again, as part of my way of narrowing down the focus a bit, I decided I wasn't going to focus on films which are clearly supposed to be, you know, suitable for children to watch, but where the main character is an adult. I think that you absolutely could consider, like, it is a children's horror film, but for just the purposes of trying to not have the corpus be too unwieldy, I decided not to include it, basically.
Yeah, I was wondering if you consider the rabbits in Watership Down to be child substitutes at all, or whether you think they're too adult in their kind of worries and concerns.
It's a good thing you asked that, actually, because in the edited collection that I've got coming out on the film, in my own chapter for that book, I basically read Watership Down as children's horror, and I read the rabbits themselves, or at least the main group of good rabbits, I read them as substitute children. Of course, there are other rabbits in the film where you can't really read them as children. It wouldn't make any sense. Like General Woundwort is clearly supposed to be the big bad adult, a bit like the witch, the Grand High Witch in The Witches is the baddie of that film, General Woundwort, and people like the chief rabbit who doesn't believe the other rabbits at the beginning, they seem to be like substitute adults, in contrast to the main group of kind of child rabbits.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, I look forward, obviously, to reading the chapter. Don't want you to, you know, spoil it too much in advance. I mean, probably the most provocative kind of statement, I think, in the whole book is really this defence of the Garbage Pail Kids movie. I think you might be the only academic to have launched an academic defence of the Garbage Pail Kids movie in existence, I suspect.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is... There's an entertaining through line in the book of kind of ribbing on Roger Ebert, which I really enjoyed. So I don't know if this was more Roger Ebert ribbing, just trying to sort of annoy the ghost of Ebert, or...
I do respect Roger Ebert very, very much. And actually, I'm not sure what he said about the Garbage Pail Kids. But yeah, he did have some strange things to say about you know, some other children's horror films. But yeah, the Garbage Pail Kids, I absolutely deserve, like, for that to be called a contentious statement. Because I have watched the Garbage Pail Kids and it's horrible. It is horrible. Although, but what I found interesting when I dug into the reviews a bit was the way that many of the reviews by adults seemed to take issue with the fact that it was about children who were basically not doing as they were told by adults, and they weren't when really what's so bad about the film is the fact that the special effects are really bad, the production values are horrible, the script is terrible. But I think there is clearly something potentially pleasurable for children about the fact that it's about these kids who decide to like overthrow like the adults who take care of them, and it ends with them riding off in the sunset with on these quad bikes that they've stolen. So yeah, I felt it was worth kind of defending on that basis, even though it's basically indefensible in practically every other respect.
I mean, you know, I think child viewers as well as adult viewers can take pleasure from these different nooks and crannies and subversive places. In terms of kind of subversive pleasures, I was really caught partly because you mention it in relation to another academic's research in The Demon Headmaster, but this idea of crazy space. Can you explain that?
Oh wow, can I explain it without having it in front of me? But yeah, so crazy space is this concept that was coined by a children's television academic called Moira Messenger-Davies, and she borrows it from the show The Demon Headmaster, in which it's used to describe this kind of nonsense language, I think, that the children use to communicate with each other. And Messenger-Davies basically takes that idea and uses it to describe certain children's television programs, and which we could also apply to film and other types of media, to describe the ways that they kind of construct these spaces that are supposed to be for children only, and which maybe adults can't quite comprehend or understand, or maybe not even aware of. So yeah, maybe I don't apply that to the Garbage Pail Kids in the book, but I think maybe you could, in that maybe for a child, they could watch it and feel like it's speaking to them on some level that they really like and resonate with. Whereas for us watching it now, we'd be like, I don't understand. This is the worst thing I've ever seen.
I don't know if Watership Down really kind of indulges in crazy space. You know, it's obviously quite a kind of gloomy-looking, melancholic sort of film. And obviously it's structured as a kind of mini-epic, really. So it's not quite that anarchic. But it's a really seductive idea, right? Crazy space. Like, So I guess the way to sort of segue into Watership Down, which is obviously the kind of main film and book we're going to be talking about today, is to ask... I mean, you've already sort of answered the question yourself, that you do potentially consider Watership Down children's horror. I mean, was Watership Down produced for a child audience?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that it wasn't. So I think it's very much a kind of anomalous film to consider children's horror in that sense, because obviously it's about rabbits rather than children, even if they are kind of childish in certain ways. But and even though now it's widely received as a children's film, or even not received as a children's film, when I bring it up, a lot of people will say, oh yeah, that's a terrifying children's film, or it's definitely not for children, which in some way seems to apply the label of children's film to it, like anyway, so, but it wasn't actually produced with a child audience in mind as the primary audience. The director, Martin Rosen, was very clear about the fact that he didn't consider it a children's film in the way that a lot of other animation of its era, like Disney films, were considered children's films. And he was very careful with the marketing of the film as well, to make it clear that it was a very dark film, I've got a poster behind me on the video, which people can't see, but it's the kind of classic poster of Bigwig's silhouette in a famous scene where he gets trapped in a snare, which gets across the sense of violence that's in the film. The trailer is very upfront about the fact that there is a lot of violence and lots of potentially unsuitable elements for children in the film. But it was then really all of these external factors which led to this widespread belief that it was for children, and therefore ended up with lots of children watching it in the cinema or on TV and becoming perhaps a bit traumatized by it, which is the reputation that it's got.
So Ren, did you want to sort of introduce both the book and the film?
As we were saying, kind of Watch It Down is sort of one of the titans of children's horror in terms of reputation, in terms of sheer numbers of children frightened. This reputation is kind of influenced by sort of these two aspects that can make people underestimate it, I guess, being about rabbits and being a cartoon. But it's the book, the novel is a 1972 adventure novel by English author Richard Adams, and it was made into animated film release in 1978, and then recently a CGI Netflix series in 2018, which we might touch on, but is not going to be our focus. As a kind of brief overview, the story follows a group of rabbits who leave their warren after one of their number, Fiver, has a premonition that destruction is coming. They cross the countryside to create a new home for themselves, and along the way they must navigate the dangers of Elil, which is what they call the thousand enemies of rabbits, the foxes and badgers and so on, and navigate the varied cruelties of men and eventually a warren that has sort of devolved into a militarised dictatorship. And along their journey they're kind of guided by their mythology about Thrith, who made the world, and Ella Raira, the resourceful and mischievous prince of rabbits. The driving force of the narrative is their need for rabbit does, as they are all boy rabbits, to continue the life of their community. And it's this need that drives them into the dangerous Warren of Ephrathah, which is led by the memorably tyrannical General Woundwort.
So, as you say, it's an adventure novel, really, and when I mentioned this to my partner Antonia, you know, she didn't really think of Watch It Down as a children's book per se, and to point it out that in the 70s there's quite a lot of her literature which focused on animals and sort of animal characters, although it's quite clearly structured around the hero's journey, so it very much recalls there's legends and myths and, say, Greek epics with the kind of call to adventure, you know, these characters having to leave their home and then facing various trials and tribulations, maybe needing to look inwards and face a kind of inner darkness and eventually kind of reaching some kind of new home or building a new community. Is it something that you watched or read as a kid, Ren, or indeed Catherine?
I'm the total newbie to it. I hadn't seen it or read it until preparing for this episode. So I am the blank slate of Watch It Down.
I actually encountered Watch It Down for the first time when I was probably around age 14. My dad decided to buy the DVD and we watched it. And then I encountered the novel a few years later when I was doing a children's literature course as part of my master's degree. And it was actually the novel that I fell head over heels in love with. I was really taken by this really complex and rich rabbit mythology that it sets out. It made me realise that rabbits actually are really cool. And they're not just these like fluffy little victims, but they can actually be quite aggressive when they want to be, and that kind of thing. And it was because of that that I now have my own two pet rabbits. Yeah. So I'm also, I came to it relatively late in life. I'm not one of the people who was exposed to it as a child and traumatized by it. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
For me, like with a lot of kind of films, I remember scenes from it. I don't think I was ever sat down to watch all of it. I think I might have caught some of it on television. And the scene that kind of stays with me is from fairly early on in the film, where they come upon Warren, which seems very kind of sedate, kind of too sedate. At first it seems almost utopian, but then the implication is it's being managed by some kind of farmer, and that the rabbits are being sort of farmed and then presumably kind of harvested for their furs or meat. It has a very odd, the rabbits they meet have this sort of slightly woozy, lilting, aristocratic way of speaking, and speaking these odd sort of poems and riddles. That's the thing I remember from Watership Down. Rather than any overt violence, I remember finding this very strange and off-putting, and not really knowing what to do with it, what sense to make of it.
Yeah. I think for a film that is about rabbits in the countryside, it has a lot of really, really striking non-naturalistic imagery peppered amongst what are very accurate and realistic kind of landscapes. And that's one of them, I think, because the Warren is kind of painted in these purple and orange colours, which is supposed to mark it out as strange and not trustworthy. And it's a very memorable part of the film.
Yeah, that was one of the bits that I was going to bring up, because I think a lot of people sort of think of the sort of most memorably kind of violent bits as sort of the horror of Watership Down. But this incident with the Warren of the Snares, or Cowslips Warren, is very creepy. It has this very sort of slow creeping horror in which they this is quite soon after they've left their home Warren, and they kind of meet this very large, healthy-looking rabbit called Cowslip, who isn't at all wary of them and is just like, oh yes, come to my burrow.
This is rather a big Warren. Yes. Please, help yourself to Fleira. There are fresh roots here daily. The man throws it out.
Man? What man?
And they're sort of, they go there, but then they start to notice that whenever they start a sentence with where, the rabbits change the subject. They're not allowed to ask any questions. And it's quite a slow build of horror.
Yeah. And then culminates in Bigwig being trapped. So then it really leads up to this explosion of violence, even though what comes before is very kind of subdued.
Which is, Bigwig trapped in the snare, which is the first kind of moment of graphic violence in the film, and probably one of the most upsetting in that it's quite protracted. So Bigwig sort of choking with the wire around his neck, and the other rabbits are trying to save him, although Cowslip kind of stops the rabbits from going out by basically saying that what will be, and that they shouldn't really interfere.
Because that's sort of the price of their comfortable life, is that these rabbits have come to accept that a number of them will die in snares, and they sort of never mention the ones that have gone.
It's very dystopian, and it's a concept that reminds me of sci-fi, actually, something like Logan's Run. Is that the one where you have a really nice life, but you only get to live up to the age of 30 or something, and then you get killed?
Yes, yeah. or almost Brave New World, with these characters who are very sort of sedate and kind of have anything they could wish for, but don't really have any freedom. So it does feel like a little sort of meditation on freedom and what these rabbits have sacrificed to have their comfortable lifestyle. So, Bigwig, should we introduce some of these characters? So it's
Bigwig is my favourite. So
Bigwig's great. We have the ensemble cast of rabbits is fairly large. So the main characters of the original group. So there's Fiver, who had the premonition to leave. There's Hazel, who is kind of designated the chief rabbit of the group. Bigwig, who's kind of the fighter, pugnacious type. Blackberry, who's the clever, crafty one. Pipkin, who's a small rabbit who sort of wants to do his best. I think that's the main lot of the sort of initial group. Then they get joined by more characters as they go along. They pick up Strawberry from this snared warren who decides to leave when they're running away after they've rescued Bigwig from the snare. And they also get a couple more survivors from their original home warren, which as it turns out was destroyed by men with diggers. And
In the new Netflix version, it's made very clear that it's a housing development. But yeah, in both adaptations, you have this rather kind of hellish scene of the warren being filled in and the rabbits sort of being suffocated to death with gases and soil, which yeah is a very upsetting scene in both the film and the Netflix version.
Yeah, and from that, Holly, who's he's one of the Owsler, right, of the
sort of rabbit, yeah. Rabbit guard or
rabbit guard, rabbit prince, rabbit, yeah, and his kind of court jester character, Bluebell, I find quite a peculiar little character, but
and they're joined by a seagull as well, of course, the wonderful yes. Kiha.
Yes, Kiha is brilliant.
I love the relationship, the like slightly antagonistic relationship between Kiha and Bigwig, especially in the film. And I would just gladly watch like a buddy film about Kiha and Bigwig.
Yeah, because Hazel has the idea that they really need all the allies that they can get. So he sort of saves a mouse that's going to be killed and says, well, a mouse could help us later in some way. And then they find Kiha, who's been injured and separated from the rest of his flock of gulls who are going to the ocean, or the big water, as he calls it. And they're only sort of able to communicate in a kind of pidgin language, because the rabbits speak Lapine. And one of the sort of really interesting aspects of the book and the film is that we get phrases of Lapine throughout it, sort of like from words for various predators, like a lendril is a badger, I think, and
when the film was released for critics to review it, critics received a glossary of all of those words. Which I think is really interesting, because viewers didn't have the benefit of that, and actually I don't really think you need it, because the book does sort of translate for you, but the film doesn't bother and it doesn't really need to, because it's always quite, you can sort of work it out depending on context and depending on what you see on the screen. It's really well done, I think.
It's definitely something that adds to the richness of the book and the film. It's something. Reading the book, I was reminded, I'm not a big Tolkien fan, to be honest, but it did remind me of Tolkien quite a bit, partly just because of the epic structure, but also in some of the world building and this, you know, the care that's put into the building up the mythology and building up the language, and this sense you get that you're seeing glimpses of what is a much larger universe. You really do get the sense, rightly or wrongly, I don't know, but reading the book, that Richard Adams had this whole thing kind of mapped out in his head, which really helps bring it to life.
Yeah, so Kat, your upcoming book is specifically about the 1978 film. What kind of approaches are you taking with that?
Well, it's an edited collection, so it's made up of about 16 chapters. One of them is written by me and the rest are written by other various experts on animation and related areas. And I've also written the introduction to the book. So it covers a wide range of things and approaches it from lots of different vantage points. So obviously my approach to the film is thinking about it as a children's horror film. We've got chapters on the kind of political allegory of the film, chapters on its production, including a chapter that's been co-written by two brothers whose father was actually an animator on the film, Arthur Humberstone. So they had access to all these amazing archival materials and have pieced together this kind of a narrative of his contributions to the film. And so hopefully when the book comes out, some of those materials will be printed in the book, which won't have been seen by most people before, which is exciting. There's also chapters on the music. Obviously, people, when you think of the Watership Down music, you would think of Bright Eyes, the song. But in the book, the two chapters on music actually focus on the score by Angela Morley, and the way that it kind of evokes horror and other kinds of emotions. And just loads of other chapters on various themes and things that the exciting things that the film is doing. And as a whole, really, I just wanted to draw more attention to this amazing film, and I was really surprised to find that not very much had been written on it in an academic context. Even though it gets written about quite a lot in the press and on social media whenever it gets broadcast on TV, especially a few years ago it was broadcast on Easter Sunday and got a bit of a backlash because of that, because people were like, oh, what are you thinking exposing children to this on Easter Sunday, you sadists, which I just thought was hilarious. So, yeah, the book as a whole, I especially wanted to put Watership Down in its context, because like I said before, it wasn't really intended to be a children's film, but for various reasons, including the fact that it's animated and about rabbits, the fact that the BBFC gave it a U certificate, which still seems completely wild. and all of these other things.
Do you know any of the reasons for this then? Because it does seem like, you know, the BBFC are normally known historically for going in the other direction, not giving a film that has quite a lot of bloody violence in it, that seems quite uncharacteristic.
So I can actually read you part of the report, which is online on their website, and they said that, quote, animation removes the realistic, gory horror in the occasional scenes of violence and bloodshed. And we felt that while the film may move children emotionally during the film's duration, it could not seriously trouble them once the spell of the story is broken, and that a U certificate was therefore quite appropriate. And the film still has a U certificate. But this is part of the reason that I think putting it in context is really important, because it does seem like really misguided that they gave it that certificate. But at the time, in 1978, the BBFC didn't have as many ratings as they do now. So they basically had the choice to give it a U and make it accessible for potentially all children, or to give it a more restrictive rating, which they didn't have the 15 at the time, but it would have been basically the equivalent of the 15. And then no children would have been able to see it. So I think basically they were weighing up their options and thinking, like, we do think that children, like, you know, some children will enjoy this. So they went for the more... what's the word? I don't know. They went for the more open approach. Mm. Yeah.
Thanks. That does help explain the reasoning behind it.
Although the fact that it's still got a U certificate, even though they could give it like a PG or a 12, is maybe a bit more questionable.
I mean, it is worth noting that the violence in it, I mean, clearly in terms of animation, now, my understanding is that there wasn't, you know, the British film industry or film industry in England has, you know, always been kind of localised in certain areas, certain parts of London, and kind of existed a bit in fits and starts. And, you know, while we might think of specific British animators, or maybe little studios, particularly obviously Aardman, from the kind of late 80s onwards, I can't think of many British animations, apart from obviously the animated version of Animal Farm, which I was definitely shown in school, and again doesn't really feel like a cartoon for children. So yeah, I don't know if there's been much in if there's much in the book about the British animation industry and where Watership Down sits in terms of that history, because obviously, yeah, this is pre-Aardman. I think when people think of kind of
That's a good question, actually, because I'm by no means, apart from Watership Down, I'm by no means an expert on sort of British animation more generally. So I'm struggling to think off the top of my head what else there might have been at that time in British animation specifically. But it is interesting that the film came out at a point in animation history where Disney was kind of waning a bit. It was a time like the studio was really struggling in the animation department at that time. Some of those films are really fondly remembered now, films like Robin Hood and The Aristocats and stuff like that. But at the time, it was seen as a bit of a low point for Disney.
Yeah.
So you had films like Watership Down, as well as films from all around the world, which were kind of emerging as these alternative adult animations. Other films included Fantastic Planet, which is a French sci-fi film. Which is really surreal. You had the Lord of the Rings animated film by Ralph Bakshi, which came out very, very close to Watership Down. So they got compared quite a lot in the press.
Yeah, visually has some similarities, actually, in terms of the kind of green and brown colour palette,
yeah,
and things looking a little bit muted and dismal at times, but also sort of pretty as well. Yeah, I can really see the visual similarity there.
Yeah, and of course you had, this is probably British, the Yellow Submarine film, the Beatles film,
of course,
which would have been the late 60s.
Mm.
So it was this really interesting time where it seemed like there was this opportunity for animation outside of the Disney studio and outside of America especially to really kind of take this opportunity, which I don't think really happened, and Disney sort of recovered around the late 80s, and then we had the Disney Renaissance. So I think because of that prominence of the Disney studio throughout like the whole of the 20th century and beyond, like any other animation that's outside of the kind of Hollywood model has to kind of try to provide some alternative in a way. And I think like British animation like Aardman is good at that. It's very clearly doing something very distinct that mainstream American animation isn't doing. The Laker stop motion films like Coraline and Paranorman are also doing that. So I don't know if that really answered your question about kind of British animation specifically, but
yeah, I think you're right that within this context of, I guess, after Walt Disney's death and the Disney studio perhaps putting money into live action
and
films,
the theme parks.
There's definitely an emergence. I mean, my own academic writing's been on Czech animation, and certainly in the 60s, that's where we see the really big, memorable feature-length Czech animated films do quite well in film festivals and on the world stage. And yeah, I think that probably is partly because Disney were quite on the most stable footing at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's worth us sort of saying that these character designs are very non-Disney, right? Apart from perhaps later Disney, like Fox and the Hound, which is a little bit less, certainly when The Fox and the Hound of that film are adults, they're not so cutesy. Because these rabbits, I mean, I don't know, like Ren, Cameron, do you find these rabbits cute in the film?
Ooh, I find all rabbits cute, but I don't know if I'm, yeah, I'm biased maybe. Ren, what do you think?
I mean, some of them are cute. They have quite big eyes when they're scared, and definitely.
If you were to put like Thumper from Bambi next to any of the rabbits in Watership Down, you would be able to see a clear difference in the level of cuteness. Although it is interesting that the animator Phil Duncan, who animated Thumper in Bambi, did work on Watership Down. And he was specifically like headhunted because they were like, oh, you're really good at animating rabbits. But they clearly, they must have kind of directed him to go a bit more realistic and not the sort of really hyper-cute aesthetic that Thumper has.
Because the rabbits, like, facially, they're a little anthropomorphized. But to me, they either look cross or scared. Like, most of the time, the rabbits either look quite, like, sort of furrowed-browed, and, you know, they'll look a bit annoyed and argumentative, or they'll look really worried and anxious, which I think is something that adds to the kind of atmosphere and the general tone of the film. And with the book doesn't really let up. You know, I don't know how you found reading it, Ren, but I was finding it quite an anxious read, because it's a one thing after another, and they are always being pursued and, you know, set upon.
I think the thing that the book has is the storytelling interludes where you get, which rabbit? Is it Dandelion who's the storyteller, telling stories of Ella Ryra and, which are kind of the sort of, well, I was going to say light relief. Some of them are actually pretty dark when you get the story of the black rabbit of Inlay, who's the kind of rabbit Grim Reaper.
Did you want to read some of that? I wasn't sure if you had any.
I haven't marked any of that. The only passage that I put down was about Blackavar.
Is that for texture of the week or?
No. Should we do texture
of the week?
Yeah, let's
do texture of the week. Okay, so should we? We're not necessarily going to force you to sing, Kat, but did you want to try to sing texture of the week to Bright Eyes, Ren? Texture. Of the week.
Cool. I'll let you do that.
When I think of Bright Eyes, I don't know. Have both of you seen The League of Gentlemen? I can't remember, Ren. Okay, so in have you seen it, Kat?
Yes, but I have no idea where this could be going.
Okay. So in The League of Gentlemen, there's this horrible character played by Steve Pemberton called Pop. Who's this sort of awful, kind of awful, slimy landlord. And there's a whole thing where he talks very emotionally about Watership Down and how he used to play it for his sons. So he starts sort of singing Bright Eyes, but he does it in this very... I'll probably just play the clip, but he does it in this really sort of awful, husky, like, you know, Bright Eyes, burning like fire.
Oh, wow.
The little rabbits, they are so brave. There are so many obstacles for them to overcome. Isn't that right, Al?
He's a good film.
So that's kind of ruined the song for me, me personally, because it's a lovely song and Art Garfunkel sings it very beautifully, but ruined.
Another thing that 90s British comedy has ruined.
Yeah,
for me.
Yeah. Do you want to start?
I'll go first because I've got this hairbrush that I'm putting up to the mic because mine is just a little line from the book where it says, And once they heard a corncrake calling as it crept along the long grass of a path verge, it made a sound like a human fingernail drawn down the teeth of a comb.
Oh, nice.
I just like that. That was quite nice.
Kat, did you choose out a texture?
Sort of, although I think I may not have interpreted texture of the week quite as literally.
That's fine. We've had some ideological textures before, like.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was basically just trying to think of stuff that I've watched in the past few days and which has really stuck with me. And this is completely different from something like Watership Down or children's horror at all. But I recently watched the new Celine Sciamma film called Petit Mama.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which landed on the streaming service Mubi last week. And I liked it so much that I watched it again the very next day.
And it is child protagonist.
It is,
right?
A child protagonist.
It's not a children's film, but it is, yeah.
I think you could say that it's a children's film. Like, children could watch it and enjoy it. But it's about a young girl who basically manages to accidentally go back in time and meet her own mother when she's the same age. So they're both supposed to be about 8, I think. And they basically just have this really lovely time together, very fleetingly, for a couple of days, which is a description that sounds so simplistic, and it is, but the film is so laden with kind of melancholy but also joy. It's just really, really lovely. And I was trying to think, is there a specific moment that I could talk about for texture of the week? But really, I think it's the tone of the sort of atmosphere of the film is very, very quiet, which is very similar to Sciamma's previous film, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is a film where music is very important, but it doesn't have a score. So there's lots of these moments of silence. And Petit Mama is very, very similar. And I don't think I'm doing it justice, but it's completely gorgeous and everyone should watch it as soon as possible.
And you say it's on Mubi at the moment,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. And it's only about 74 minutes long. It's just this perfect little gem.
I it is on my watch list on Mubi, so I will make an effort to watch it now. And it sounds like one that I could actually watch for my stepdaughter, maybe.
Yeah.
I think that sounds like a good length as well.
Yeah.
So for my texture, I was going to go for General Woundwort's face, which is sort of, I don't know what the word, like, it's not rumpled exactly, but it looks, I don't know, it looks kind of scarred and sort of scraggly, and it's really textured. Like, you can really imagine, like, probably not scruffling this rabbit's face because he'd probably, like, bite your hand off. But he looks really, he's definitely the fleshiest of all the rabbits in the film.
Yeah.
He's very imposing.
You tell your chief bigwig that if he and Heisenthray and the others aren't waiting outside when I come for them, I'll tear out every throat in the place.
I think one of the screenshots that seems to get shown a lot is of General Woundwort at the end in the tunnel, kind of bearing down on the rabbits with his sort of bleeding from various bits of his face and his kind of mismatched eyes. It's quite an imposing sight. I should probably explain a little bit more of the plot in case people are entirely lost. But as I said, they want to get does for their warren so that they don't just die out. And Kiha goes out scouting and says that there's a warren sort of fairly nearby that they could go and investigate. So Holly and a couple of others end up going first, kind of come back very sort of traumatized and possibly injured and say, like, yeah, this is this warren isn't a normal warren. They're it's a highly sort of militarized regime where all of the rabbits have their own mark, which is like a literal mark, like a scar on their body to show which sort of regiment they belong to, and they're only allowed to go out and eat at certain times, and they're all controlled by the Ausler and the Efrafra. That is right, isn't it? Efrafra.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they send out patrols to sort of scout the area, and so they kind of barely manage to escape from Efrafra. But Holly does come back with the information that there are those there who want to leave, but they're just not allowed to. So Hazel still thinks that it's their best chance to get those for the Warren. So they come up with this plan where Bigwig is going to go in and sort of infiltrate Efrafra and say he wants to join, which is this quite a good little plan, because he goes to General Windwort and says, "Oh, I want to join Efrafra," and General Windwort's kind of what sort of why? But he can't say why would you want to join us, because
he's probably so, quite touched. Really, he's quite like, "Oh, yeah. No one's ever said that before."
So Bigwig becomes an officer and sort of is kind of second in command in a mark, and there he finds the doe Heisenflay, who was the sort of the leader who wanted to leave the Warren, and kind of manages, with the help of Kiha, they manage to escape. But while he's there, Bigwig also decides that they're going to bring Blackavar with them, who is a rabbit who tried to escape and was horribly punished as a result. So I'm just going to read the description of when Bigwig comes across Blackavar. It says, "This rabbit had very dark fur, almost black, but this was not the most remarkable thing about him. He was dreadfully mutilated. His ears were nothing but shapeless shreds, ragged at the edges, seamed with ill-knit scars and beaded here and there with lumps of proud bear flesh. One eyelid was misshapen and closed askew. Despite the cool, exciting air of the July evening, he seemed apathetic and torpid. He kept his gaze fixed on the ground and blinked continually. After a time, he lowered his head and rubbed his nose on his forepaws in a listless manner. Then he scratched his neck and settled down in the former drooping position. Bigwig, his warm, impulsive nature stirred by curiosity and pity, went across the run. 'Who are you?' he asked. 'My name is Blackavar, sir,' replied the rabbit. He did not look up and spoke without expression, as though he had answered this question many times before. 'Are you going to Silflow?' said Bigwig. No doubt he thought this was some hero of the Warren, wounded in a great fight and now infirm, whose past services merited an honourable escort when he went out. 'No, sir,' answered the rabbit. 'Why ever not?' said Bigwig. 'It's a lovely evening.' 'I don't Silflow at this time, sir.' 'Then why are you here?' asked Bigwig, with his usual directness. 'The mark that has the evening Silflow, sir,' began the rabbit. 'The mark that has... they come, I...' He hesitated and fell silent. One of the Auslaffer spoke. 'Get on with it,' he said. 'I come here for the mark to see me,' said the rabbit, in his low, drained voice. 'Every mark should see how I have been punished, as I deserve for my treachery in trying to leave the Warren. The council were merciful. The council were merciful. The council... I can't remember it, sir, I really can't,' he burst out, turning to the sentry who had spoken. 'I can't seem to remember anything.'"
It's quite harrowing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They do escape.
They do escape.
They do escape. And I can't remember. It's actually been a while since I've read the novel in full. But I think Blackavar survives in the novel. But in the film, sadly, he does not. And actually, I think of all the deaths in the film, and there are a lot, he probably has the most horrific one. Because he's kind of, I think he's kind of torn apart by either Woundwort or one of the other evil rabbits. And you get this shot of him with these huge gouges in his side and just this blood pouring out. It's really quite gruesome.
I mean, the film really escalates in terms of its violence. So the last third is definitely the most violent and bloody. I was watching it with my stepdaughter, Matt, and she was saying, "Oh, I thought this had a reputation being violent in the first half, and like, oh, you know, there's nothing. And then by the end of it, it was like, oh god, okay, that was a bit much, you know. I think especially when the dog starts, they part of the plan is to let this dog loose, and so the dog is having a great old time of it. The dog's probably like, this is the best day I've ever had. Not so fun for the rabbits,
because the rabbits make it back from Ephrafa to the warren, but they are followed by Moonwort. In the film, this sort of happens immediately. In the book, there's a bit of a gap, but they are trying to turn quite a long book into quite a short film, and I think they did a very good job of it. But yeah, there's this final sort of climactic scene where, and Bigwig kind of memorably buries himself in the earth to have the element of surprise on General Moonwort as he's coming down the tunnel.
I think that concision is really to the benefit of the film, because we mentioned the recent Netflix or BBC adaptation, which you can watch on Netflix, and it's much longer than the film. I think there are 4 episodes, which reach about 45 to 50 minutes long. And to be honest, I mean, I think in the book, there's a fair amount of rabbit politicking, I suppose. You know, the rabbits obviously discuss their plans quite a lot, and you get more of those dynamics. The film is a bit choppier. It is a bit more episodic, perhaps. But I think that works really well for the film. Personally, I found the BBC adaptation a little bit boring. If I'm honest, it does drag a little bit, and it's a shame because it has a really star-studded cast, you know, who will do really well with the voice acting. I recently watched The Detectorists, so I was quite happy to hear Mackenzie Crook as one of the rabbits. But it's CGI, and you know, I've probably on the podcast have spoken of my love for stop motion before, and generally having less time for CGI, I do think that some of Pixar's films are brilliant and have a lot of time for Moana. So I think CGI can work when it suits the material. Here, I guess the budget isn't quite what you would expect for, say, a Pixar production. It is a BBC budget, and the animation does look... it looks a little bit stark, perhaps, a little bit lifeless.
A bit dated as well. When it was broadcast, lots of the reactions on social media were like, oh, am I watching a cutscene from a PS2 game? You know, which is maybe a bit harsh, but I think understandable. Because, yeah, it's just... considering that the film has got... a lot of the time it does have a muted colour palette, but it does also have lots of really beautiful and stark and colourful imagery, especially in some of those surreal... sections. And the series, in trying to go for an even more realistic aesthetic, it just ends up looking really drab and plain.
It's how I felt about the so-called live action Disney remake of The Lion King. And I think it speaks to how animation as a medium, at its most expressive, it can, you know, it can transform the world. And I think the original Watership Down uses abstraction really well. So actually those bits that stay in the mind, like I think particularly the Bright Eyes sequence, it's really, really pared down. It's very minimal. You've basically just got these two black silhouettes so dancing about on the screen with very little background. And it's really abstracted. And yeah, that's very evocative and stays in the mind a lot better than the kind of attempt at a more photorealistic style, which again is limited by the budget. But even if it were more high budget, I still think that the more abstract style of animation, that stylization, like you talk about the colours in the original film, and I think that's... it creates much more of an interesting atmosphere, much more of a dreamlike atmosphere, than a more realistic style.
And I think a great missed opportunity with the series is that it does open with this really, really stunning prologue, So similar to the film, it opens with a prologue about how the sun god Frith, which is the rabbit kind of religion, how it created the world and all the animals. And it's depicted in this really beautiful shadow puppet style. It's completely gorgeous. And then it drops that and doesn't come back to it at all. And I just think it's also a shame, not only that they didn't continue with that sort of more expressionist style, but also that they didn't take the opportunity to include more of those interludes. Because in the novel, you have lots of those stories about El Herrera and the Black Rabbit of Inlay, and it, which really builds out the rabbit mythology, which you can't include in the film. Like, it's understandable that they didn't try to squeeze some of those in. But the series had the opportunity to do that because it was longer form. And I think it's a real shame that they didn't take that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is a bit of a missed opportunity. Yeah, which is a shame. But obviously, as with remakes, they don't efface the originals. You know, if you watch the Netflix one and find it lacking, you can always, of course, go back to Rosen's original. Yeah.
There was also a TV series made in 1999, which was in traditional animation and broadcast on CITV. It does have its fans, although it's not quite as well known as the film. So if people are wanting to see a more long form adaptation of Watership Down and is not as ugly as the Netflix BBC series, then they could look at that. Although because it was made for CITV, it basically strips away all of the violent content from the novel.
It looks visually actually quite similar to The Animals of Farthingwood, which is a show I grew up with and a show that's often spoken about in the same breath as Watership Down, and surely a show influenced by Watership Down, and which obviously has a much wider cast of characters. It starts with a similar inciting incident of housing development or something being built on the kind of home.
The hedgehog gets run over by a truck, and it's very upsetting.
Yeah, so in some ways, maybe not as graphically violent, but in terms of the variety of deaths, more extreme than Watership Down, because there's a variety of different animals. I think possibly the kestrel or one of the birds ends up in a cement mixer.
Oh my god!
which is particularly upsetting.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, Animals of Farthingwood is another one I think that is sort of known for its levels of violence that unsuspecting kids were probably troubled or haunted by. I remember playing with my friend Edward when I was little, had figurines, and we'd do our own Animals of Farthingwood stories. in terms of the kind of...
I need to, friend of the pod, Ava, insisted that I mention when we talk about Watership Down, the Watership Down themed crust punk band full of Ephrafa, that her friend George was the drummer in, who created a trilogy of Watership Down themed albums called Owsler, Elil and Inlay in the late 2000s.
Oh, wow.
If you want to enjoy Watership Down in a completely different genre, then.
And I note that Steve Jackson Games released quite early, actually, a Watership Down role playing game, like a tabletop one. I think possibly in the 80s or something. So it's had a long legacy in many ways.
Yeah, it's been adapted to theatre and radio as well, I believe.
I can really imagine it working well on stage, actually, and you could really kind of push the abstraction there. And then obviously Rosen went on to direct another film, which really isn't a children's horror, Plague Dogs. Which, if anything, just doubles down on the misery in Watership Down. Plague Dogs is a much more downbeat, more upsetting film than Watership Down. Like, I historically have not been keen on dogs, although my partner and I have been living with dogs now for 2 years, and I have started to consider them my dogs as well, Olive and Eddie. So I have come to love them. Olive almost despite herself, who she's a poodle cross and exhibits all the wit and intelligence and irritating qualities that you would associate with poodles. But when I watched Plague Dogs, I definitely wasn't a dog person at all. It made me cry. And yeah, I really found it quite crushing. And the dogs in that are also on the run and escaping, but from a laboratory. They've been subject to vivisection, and the two dogs are trying to survive. On the moors.
I actually only watched Plague Dogs for the first time and probably the last time a few months ago, and I thought I would be prepared for it because of Watership Down, but I was not, and it was just relentlessly bleak. Like a very skillful film, I think, for what it's trying to do, but not something I want to subject myself to ever again.
Yeah, if you imagine like Lars von Trier or someone, or like Haneke making an animation about animals, that's pretty much what it's like. It's quite astonishingly bleak.
Yeah, and for all the crap that Watership Down gets for being violent, it is at least, I think, really an optimistic film, and at least ends in a way that feels really uplifting, and does have moments of comedy, for example, with Kiha the seagull, which help to give it a bit more of a tonal balance, whereas Plague Dogs, it's just misery from beginning to end.
It's relentless. Yeah. It really is. I don't know if you haven't seen it, have you, Ren?
Don't.
Yeah, I don't. I wouldn't, if I'm honest. I don't think you'd get on with it. I mean, I'll say this, right? I've shown my stepkids. I'm going to forget. What's the really miserable Ghibli film with the kids in
Grave
in the
of the Fireflies?
Yeah, I've shown my stepkids Grave of the Fireflies. I will say that my 10-year-old stepson wasn't bothered by it at all, and mostly just commented on all the logistical mistakes they were making in terms of staying alive. But, you know, that's George. I would never show them Plague Dogs. There's no way. Like, I would not do that. So that's a warning for anyone who like listens to this, like, oh, maybe I'll watch Plague Dogs. Tread lightly, it's a heavy watch. And the only other thing I wanted to mention that I think it might have influenced is the very long running book series Warrior Cats, that I know a lot about from my stepdaughter, who's like a lifelong fan. And Warrior Cats seems quite similar in terms of all the kind of cat politics and cats under threat. But it doubles down on the religious themes a lot more. Like, the kind of whole religion and spirituality in Warrior Cats is, like, very deep and rich and complicated. So that was Matt's observation watching Warship Down. It was basically, wow, they don't go into the religion very much. I think felt that it was quite lightly sketched.
I've never heard of Warrior Cats, but I like cats and I like, you know, Warship Down. So it sounds like something I would enjoy.
Yeah, it's a very long running young adult book series. I think, you know, they probably started at just the point you would have probably been just too old for it. It's very big in the Netherlands, actually. Like, when I was in the Netherlands in Maastricht, like, there were posters up for like the audiobook of it, like at bus stops. I don't think it's so well known in Britain, but in America and some of Europe, it's very big. We might cover it at some point. It certainly gets very violent, as the name would imply. Are there any other last little thoughts on Watership Down?
I have so many.
We've only had about an hour.
Maybe something that's interesting to highlight that I haven't had a chance to yet is the fact that when it was released, the critical reception was actually not that great. It tends to be thought of now as either like traumatizing, but still kind of at least respected as a work of art, and some people are very, very fond of it as well. But when it came out, like, some of the critical reception was actually very, very mixed, which was something I was really surprised to find out when I went digging and finding those contemporary reviews. Which I just think is really interesting and shows us how something like Rotten Tomatoes is a bit useless sometimes when it doesn't, because Rotten Tomatoes would have you think that it's very, very well respected, which it is now, but Rotten Tomatoes doesn't have any of those older historical reviews. And there's one in particular which I kind of want to read out just because it's so mean. It was a dual review of Watership Down and The Lord of the Rings by an animation historian called Michael Barrier. And he basically said that he found Watership Down to be, quote, very stupid. And he said that there was no, quote, no sign that any intelligence was at work in making the film, and that it was so unremarkable that it's almost as if Watership Down had never been released at all. But I think the film ended up proving him wrong. Wow. Because it's now very well remembered and loved by lots of people.
And on that bombshell,
thank you so much, Kat, for joining us to talk about Watership Down and children's horror in general. It's been really brilliant to have your perspectives on it.
And can you remind us of when, so your book, Horror Films for Children, Fear and Pleasure in American Cinema, is already out, and I definitely recommend it. It's a great read and covers a lot of real classics of the genre that, you know, you, I think, done great work in actually arguing for as a genre. And when's the book on Watership Down coming out?
As far as I know, it's set for release in September of this year, although I know publishing deadlines can move about, so who knows? But hopefully it won't be too long.
That's great. Awesome.
Brilliant. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. Our outro music's by Joe Kelly. You can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod or email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com. And leave us a nice review if you want on Apple Podcasts or whatever.
Stay safe, creepy kids, and don't watch Plague Dogs. Just don't do it. Don't do it to yourselves. Bye.
Bye for now.
Awesome.